911, what's your grievance?
It's more of an emergency.
Oh!
And that'll do it, I guess.
And that'll do it. Welcome back to the First Risk Podcast, everybody. It has been so long.
So long. We missed you so much.
Every day. I went to bed and I would pray to God that I would say, just bring them back to me. Just bring them back to me. How long will Jane be in the United Kingdom? Ooh.
Yes. We're so sorry we had to take an unexpected week off last week, but in hindsight, I don't know why we thought we would be able to keep recording while I was in London, because it turned out my schedule was really, really busy. I would start, you know, I would start my day with press screenings at like 8 a.m. and then I'd be just out downtown watching movies until sometimes as late as like midnight, basically. And I had no time. And that's on top of like the time difference. We literally did not have a way to record an episode last week. I took my microphone with me and everything, thinking I would, but it became very clear immediately that I would not be able to.
You were so busy. I don't even think we texted a lot, like, over the past week.
No, barely. I would occasionally text you, like, I'm about to watch Pillion, that movie about gay BDSM, which is good, by the way.
Which looks so good. It looks so good. I'm so excited to see it. But hey, Jane, you're not the only one who saw some cinema, because on Thursday of whatever day or week it was, I think it was 2 weeks ago, maybe it was last week, I don't remember. But on a Thursday, I saw one of the very first screenings in North America of Kiss of the Spider-Woman, and it was so good. It was so good.
For some reason, I was expecting you to say it was really bad.
What?
I just know that, like, the original film and the musical, I think, were, maybe I'm misremembering, but I thought they had gotten, like, mixed reviews. And then, you know, you throw in J-Lo, who is a great actress, but doesn't always
pick the best
roles. Case in point, Boy Next Door.
Let me tell you this. I had no doubts about it going into it once I saw J-Lo and Diego Luna in the cast.
Right.
And Tonatiuh, I think I might be saying that wrong. He gave the performance of a lifetime. But I was so excited going into it, because I love Kiss of the Spider-Woman.
I am very excited.
Kander and Ebb's most underrated show, I think. And I remember I found out about it. Actually, I first found out about it when I was 17, because I was doing like a pre-college program for musical theater. And it was a very different point in my life. Not that different, actually. I did end up going to the college. And I was assigned Dressing Them Up, which is a song like that's early on in the show. And it was cut for the movie. They cut a lot of the songs that take place in the prison itself. And they relegated most of them to like the fantasy sequences, which I actually thought was a really strong choice, because it created a clear delineation between like what was real and what was fantasy. And that was like the whole point of the movie. So I appreciated that. And oh my God, I forgot that movies shot on digital could have color. I forgot that things could look interesting and also be interesting. I lost the magic of like big cinema choreography for a while there, and this movie revived so much of it. All the performances were incredible. The mixing they did for all of the songs was fantastic. And it was really well directed, and it was just a great piece of art, you know. So I was so excited. I took my film snob friend, my snobbiest cinephile friend, took me actually to the film. He really enjoyed it. I was expecting to look over and him be like, that wasn't my favorite. And he was like, no, I liked it. I'm like, yes.
I'm glad to hear Bill Condon is back to his roots of directing good movie musicals, because, you know, we were floundering a little in the Twilight Breaking Dawn parts 1 and 2, and Beauty and the Beast live action remake, and Greatest Showman of it all few years there. He didn't direct that one. He just wrote it. But, you know, glad to hear it. I'm definitely excited. Yeah, I've just seen like 30 movies not including the like 21 short films I saw. So we've both been, there's just so much has happened since, like in 911 news, the whole thing with like Rockman Dunbar lost his lawsuit against
my
Disney.
God.
You guys, if anyone's like totally tuned out of this, basically Rockman Dunbar, the actor who played Michael on 911, a couple years ago launched a lawsuit against Disney for, he thought he had been discriminated against because the show chose to let him go after he refused to get the COVID vaccine. He said that the reason he refused to get the vaccine was his like new agey Hollywood religion, the Church of Universal Wisdom. And I guess they've been waging this lawsuit for a couple years now. And the verdict is in, he lost. And there's a very funny article from like, deserved. I forget if it's like Hollywood Reporter or Variety, but like it painted a very honestly funny picture. So, you know, wish him the best, but also like get your kids vaccinated, bestie.
When will Jane stop affording horrible men the benefit of the doubt?
It's not that I am trying to give horrible men the benefit of the doubt. It's just that I have learned to try and be nuanced, especially when talking about like real people, because you never know sometimes. You know, I'm trying to be more of a, I'm trying to have some journalistic integrity.
You could have just written a funny Variety article, you know? So yes, I also saw that, and that was very funny.
Can I just read a little passage from this article?
Please indulge us.
Okay, the 8-member federal jury found unanimously in favor of Disney-owned 20th Television. When the verdict was read, Dunbar put his head in his hands. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, he shouted, and then turned to his wife and children who were sitting in the gallery. I'm so sorry, we'll be okay. I don't mean to make light of what is clearly an emotional moment for him, but something about like the way that's written out in the article, and that he was so confident apparently that he would win, which is kind of ridiculous. Here's another quote from him, from his testimony. Man created the COVID vaccine to separate you from God, he said. This is a spiritual war. This is a war of evil against good. I stood on the side of good. I stood on the side of God. I stood on the shoulders of God.
I'm sure he sounded so unhinged and crazy saying this on the stand, and I would love to see a video of it.
I know, I wish this had been recorded.
But I'm trying to imagine him saying it in character as Michael Grant, doing that sort of like gruff.
Well,
sort
yeah,
of
you know,
like,
he brought the drama because he is a good actor.
Soft thing, yeah, like just God created the COVID vaccine to separate. Oh no, no. Man created.
Fuck. God would never, right?
God would never do his kids like
okay,
that.
But then the next paragraph is also whiplash because it says Disney's lawyers argued that Dunbar lacked credibility. She noted that Dunbar routinely takes synthetic testosterone and anastrozole, which the leader of the Congregation of Universal Wisdom called, quote, sacrilegious. So what, like the leadership of the church doesn't even claim him?
So it's like, so it's not about the, I mean, obviously the religion's like the air quotes religion is just an excuse. He's just anti-vax, right? He's just anti-vax.
But I guess like when I made my video and outlined this, I guess I kind of naively assumed that he was genuinely invested in that religion. But in her closing argument, Rodriguez scrolled through a list of 37 medications Dunbar has taken.
I understand why like some people immediately would be like skeptical of like the legal system not siding with him when he's making like a claim that like on the face is about like, I don't know, spiritual differences or I don't know, mm-hmm. whatever. But like I mean, look at the material, right? Like, if there's a man here claiming that, you know, getting the COVID getting fired for refusing the COVID vaccine is discrimination against his religion because he didn't want to on religious grounds. He refused on religious grounds. and in the same breath is also like, you know, taking shots of like synthetic testosterone or like, you know, like steroids or whatever the fuck he's doing to, like, I don't know, min-max his workouts. Not the gender-affirming
care. Like, what is even going on there?
The gender-affirming care. What does this new age Hollywood religion think about HRT? That's my next question. But I guess we'll get there. right now it's just about the synthetic testosterone and the COVID vaccine. He's just anti-vax. He just is.
Yeah,
we can all accept that at this point, right?
He's right, a hypocrite. But I guess the saga is over because he has officially lost the lawsuit.
And he'll never work again. He'll never work again in like a major Hollywood production.
The real
production.
Thing is, like, he probably could have like gotten away with it if he had just quietly like left the show and left it at that. But now, like, yeah, he's kind of established himself as this like crazy, weird, you know, person who's willing to die on this weird religious anti-vax hill. And that's a lot more alienating to people than just kind of quietly refusing to take the vaccine because of your spiritual
I think
reasons.
Even calling it religious is like, it's giving it too much like credibility. It's like not it's clearly not based in an institution,
but, you know, purportedly, you know, religious.
He could very well be the next Zachary Levi, you know, and that could be the route that he goes down, which I don't want for him because he's a talented
you and
actor.
Zachary Levi.
I hate Zachary Levi with every fiber of my being. Okay,
as you should. But otherwise, okay. 911 season 9 has started airing. I admit I've only seen the first episode and two.
I'm sorry. I'm still on Zachary Levi. Zachary Levi.
No, we're moving on. I'm sorry.
Bobby Nash died because he got the COVID vaccine.
I'm taking the reins. We are not wasting time discussing Zachary Levi. So 911 season 9 is airing. I've only seen the first episode. You guys, I need to clarify. It's currently
I've also only seen the first episode.
It's currently 12:15 a.m. on London time. I can't believe I haven't said this yet. I flew back from London today. I got in like 3 hours ago. So I'm a little eepy on this recording session.
She's a little
so
eepy.
I hope I can stay focused, but if I don't sound like I'm staying focused, I did not take any edibles. It's just the jet lag. Anyway, yeah, the season started airing. I only watched the first episode because, again, I was so busy. Like, I didn't really have time. And this is kind of silly, but, like, I didn't see anybody talking about the second episode. Like, it seemed to have gone over in a very kind of, like, non-controversial and not anything to write home about kind of way. So I was like, you know what, I think it's okay if I just wait until
which is insane, by the way, which is insane. Athena's in space. Athena true, and Hannah are in space.
True. And nobody even moved. Nobody batted an eye.
Nobody.
Everybody was like,
my face, their face killing me, why nobody give a fuck, you know?
It's like, I'm not saying it was bad, like, but the only things I've seen about the second episode are just like some people saying, like, I liked it. It was pretty good. And some people being like, I didn't really like it. Not enough Eddie or whatever.
Okay. No, I'm in a similar boat. I also didn't see any chatter about it. And so I just did other things. I also have an excuse. I have been at home this whole time. But I do have an excuse, which is that we've been scrambling to find a new apartment because we finally got our 30-day notice to vacate.
My
illegal squatter era is officially coming to an end. I will be paying rent soon. Just have to finish our applications for these places that we're looking at. Jesus Christ, it's very stressful, but we're making it through, and we are still I still watched the first episode, and I liked the first episode. I really enjoyed it.
you know, I think the opening emergencies are always like perfectly fine enough for the most part, and also like we know we're not going to get like deep into character stuff yet, so that's the other reason it feels like it can wait. It's like, well, you know, it'll start to really matter in like episodes like 4 or 5, maybe. That's where we really have to start paying attention. So anyway, we don't have much to say about like the beginning of season 9, because so far it's just kind of passed without incident. But soon enough, perhaps we will. Anyway, we better start talking about the episode. Today we're covering season 4, episode 4, 911, What's Your Grievance? Directed by Brenna Malloy, written by Nadia Abbas-Madden.
Let's get this show on the road. Let's do it. Season 4, episode 4.
What's your 911, What's Your Grievance? We open on a delightful neighborhood block party. Not everyone is delighted, though, because, it's the white lady from Abbott Elementary, I think.
Melissa! Melissa, yes. Yes, she is. How delighted I was to see her as not just a guest star, but this guest star in this episode.
Yes, she's playing, I guess we could call her a Karen type. She's like a neighbor who is just apparently like terrorizes her neighborhood. She hates fun. She hates community. She sees what looks like a very pleasant kind of approachable block party and like in broad daylight. And she decides to call 911 about it. There's also, I have to say, there's sort of an implicit like racially charged element here. She gets on the phone with 911 and May is answering the call and she keeps saying like these people like whatever she actually opens the call by saying like these neighborhood kids, they're shooting at me. So of course May thinks it's like a real shooting, but then this lady reveals it's water guns. So it's kind of and it's just reminiscent of those like racially charged Karen like situations we would see, especially during COVID at the time, like people calling the cops on black people if they, what was that famous video, like somebody walking their dog in the park or something and this lady calls the cops on him.
And got fired from her job.
In real life, had the next thing that happens to this lady not happened to her, she probably would have gone viral and gotten fired and had her life ruined.
instead, she got her life overed. No, it was topical. It was topical. So, you know, good on them. So May answers the call. And Josh is supervising her. She's still in training. And Melissa is over here. It's not her character's name. I'm just going to call her that. Melissa is over here, like, massive Karen, like, demanding to speak to May's boss. Like, May reminds her that, like, making a fraudulent 911 call is a misdemeanor.
Yeah, Josh is, like, about to help her out, but she's, like, kind of motions to him, like, I got this. And she very righteously dresses this lady down, puts her in her place. Yeah.
And then the episode, there's a really smart perspective shift here where we go entirely to May, where we hear through the line, Melissa, you know, she's like, I'll deal with it myself. And then she's like, oh my God, what are you doing back here? No. Ah. And then gunshot.
Yeah.
Gunshot.
Right. Oh.
She is dead in the pool.
Dead in the pool.
Shot right in the abdomen. Right in the abdomen. And Athena Grant is on the scene with the 118 in tow. They are wearing LAFD branded masks. It is so cute. I love
so
it.
So cute.
Rockman Dunbar would never.
Hey, we don't know that he's anti-mask, just anti-vax.
I'm just saying the Venn diagram is Venn diagramming.
It's true. It's more likely than not. But they're like fishing this lady out of the pool like she's a bundle of dead leaves. And buddies start like armchair detectiving. They're like, they get really into it. They're like, it's like a locked room mystery. Like, look at all this evidence. And Athena goes like, are we making a true crime podcast? And for the record,
oh my God,
we would all listen to Buddy's true crime podcast, right?
We would all listen to Buddy's podcast. I would tune in every episode. I don't even listen to true crime podcasts, and I would be all over that.
The dynamic would be so great. It would be like, you know, Buck is the one who does the research and comes in with like the facts, and then Eddie just sits there and goes like, whoa, that's crazy, while listening so lovingly and attentively.
Yeah, it would be a much better podcasting record for Eddie than the actor who plays him. I did pause and write in my notes just podcasts mentioned. I felt a little called out by that.
Drink for podcasts.
Drink for podcasts. Nobody knows who killed. Okay, so her name is Delia, but her name's Melissa. Fabrizio barges in, tripping over a garden gnome, you know, and is like, ugh, she looks like she died. I can see the Statue of Liberty already.
I'm tripping over the garden gnomes.
Do you think he found it offensive in his latent Italian?
It's hard to say. It's hard to say. Yeah. But they notice that Hen has noticed that Delia's nails are chipped, like something happened there. So it's like hard to tell what happened. Like, was there a struggle or what? But they realize they find all this mail, like, in her backyard. She's been stealing people's mail.
Yeah. Athena calls Buddy Cagney and Lacey, which feels like soft hinting at Buddy, because Cagney and Lacey was, like, well known as, like, the gayest not gay show on television. So that was funny.
It's kind of like when they do Miami Vice. Like, I feel like people think of that as a homoerotic police show as well, although I could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Cagney and Lacey, it's also such a, I was really tickled by, like, the datedness of this reference. Like, I feel like they could have easily written in a line where Buck is like, what's Cagney and Lacey?
Right.
As we heard in the pilot episode, as far as he's concerned, the world began the day he was born or whatever. Like, he canonically doesn't know or care about old-timey references.
And it was such an in-character reference for Athena, because you know she was tuning into every fucking episode of that show. Yeah. Every single one. Every
She's like, this is my life.
me and Maynard were Cagney and Lacey.
These ladies tell it how it is.
We find out from Athena that you know, Delia is not just a male thief. A female male thief.
Right. We were all confused.
She was also a serial caller, mm-hmm. of 911. She has called 911 from her home 13 times in the last 6 months. Like,
it's like, girl, get a hobby.
Karen isn't strong enough. She's I don't know. She's like an Agnes or an Esther, you know, like this is a deranged woman. OK. And so that's establishing the mystery, the lingering mystery of this episode, which I must say proceeds like sort of unfolds throughout the episode in a very lighthearted way, which is very funny. Yes. Because a woman is dead in her pool.
Yeah, and the fact that it contrasts with this very, like, earnest emotional storyline going on with, like, Buck and Maddie and Chimney. So it once again feels a little like that Degrassi school shooting episode dilemma of, like, pairing your most serious A plots with your silliest
Joey Jeremiah plots. Selling his house.
Right. So I just wanted to bring that up.
Athena is definitely the Joey Jeremiah of this episode.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of that storyline, we cut to the Madney household. Chimney is violently blending a smoothie, and it even has this sort of, like, sickly pink, almost fleshy color to it. And
what do you mean by that? It's a strawberry banana smoothie.
Yeah, but I feel like they intentionally made it look kind of like salmon pink to match the color of flesh and sinew to let us know that something is frightening and amiss.
Girl, what? Maybe.
I'm doing serious analysis and criticism, and I don't appreciate how not on board you are. I've just gotten back from a film festival.
No, man. You're right. The salmon smoothie was all about the inner turmoil of Maddie's flesh and blood.
It symbolizes their feelings of unease. So anyway, Maddie comes in and she's like, I need to tell Buck that our parents are coming to visit. Ruh-roh. And Chimney reminds her, he's like, that's the thing you want to tell him about, not the thing you told me. So we're still getting, they're still like edging us about this mystery. Maddie
very
is now
well,
apparently
I should
told,
say.
Yes, Maddie has now apparently told Chimney the big Buckley family secret, but we still don't know. And Chimney is clearly struggling to sit on this secret without letting Buck know or anyone else.
Sitting on a secret.
Yeah, that's my 1972 pop hit. One hit wonder.
Yeah. Chimney knows, and we don't. And like, throughout this conversation, it's quite well done, sort of like the soft reveals that we get throughout this conversation of, like, Maddie was forced into secrecy about the incident or whatever when she was 9 years old. 9 years old. So we're learning not only about what the secret is, but also more so the depths of her parents, I guess you could say, derangement. this whole thing. And it's even crazier when you learn the context at the end of this episode. Or you don't even fully learn the context at the end of this episode, but you kind of do. It's a whole thing. And basically the Buckleys are coming to town. The Buckleys are coming to town. She doesn't know how she's going to tell Buck, right? Because to put it mildly, Buck is not close with his parents. And it doesn't hold them in the highest regards, deservedly so. And Chimney, Chimney's the worst secret keeper in the entire world. Okay, so now yes. He has to keep the secret from Buck, and they have to be in the same room together because the Buckleys are coming to town, and he's putting him in this very uncomfortable situation. She's like, how do you feel about that? And he hits the blender. I'm sorry. No, I didn't mean to, like, you know, bulldoze over your blender color matching film analysis. I respect it.
It was very clearly an intentional choice to make the blender smoothie so fleshy and unappetizing.
I think the reason I had the reaction I did is because I saw it and I was like, oh, that looks good.
Okay, well, can't relate. We cut to
it's a
Maddie.
Strawberry banana smoothie, probably with vanilla yogurt. It looks so yummy.
We cut to Maddie breaking the news to Buck. He's making this hilariously betrayed face as he confirms that Maddie has invited their parents to visit.
I'm sorry, the range Oliver Stark is showing in this episode is
pretty
insane.
Crazy. Mm-hmm. He's like looking at her though, like she's just told him that, I don't know, she's gonna run for president. He's very shocked and confused. Yeah. And
he looks like he's been shot, you know, kind of. And we get a brief mention of, like, you know, he's like, why didn't you tell me sooner? And she's like, well, you were in Texas, you know, so interesting piece of continuity.
I don't know what they're referring to, but I guess Buck recently took a trip to Texas and we didn't see it.
Exactly. Eddie's parents.
Maddie trying to justify her actions is like, you know, I want my daughter to have a normal family, like grandparents and an uncle and whatnot. And Buck is like, too bad you couldn't have like had a baby with a guy that had those, which is such a like weirdly cruel thing to say. they kind of just brush over it. Maddie's like, that's not funny. It's like, yeah, no, it's really not. Why would you say that?
Because he's upset, obviously, you know, he's backed into a corner, he's lashing out, he's like, you know, and he makes a little joke about, like, I'm gonna need more therapy, etc. And it's like, it's like, honey, if you only knew.
But Maddie says basically she's willing to try. And she also mentions, you know, it's okay, Chimney's going to be there, and so will Albert. And Buck's like, really? Cut to the Han brothers.
My God.
Having a little shirtless basketball game.
I died.
This was Ryan fan service, essentially.
It was ridiculous Ryan fan service.
They're both very muscular and good looking, and they're playing basketball in the brilliant sun, looking like two basketball playing Adonises. And Chimney's kind of complaining to Albert about how he's got to keep this big secret. You know, everybody knows I can't keep a secret, which I guess we know now that he said it to us. But that is kind of Chimney's whole thing in this episode, is him struggling to keep this secret.
Has he ever kept the secret in the past? Wait, actually, I want to do a continuity check. I have no idea if he's ever had to keep a secret in the past.
Possibly. But Chimney is like, I can't, you know, keep this to myself anymore. I've got to tell you, Albert, you're going to know. And Albert's like, please don't do that. And then,
my God.
As he's like, no, I'm going to tell you, Albert just bolts. He runs for the hills.
He runs away. He runs into the woods.
And, you know, I guess that is an effective strategy.
I love Albert so much. He's so sweet. I wish his actor wasn't successful so he would stay on the show for longer.
Back in the 118 station, Bobby is taking some, like, beautiful-looking roast or something out of the oven. And we hear that Buck is having an emergency therapy session, which is scary, but everybody seems pretty chill about it. They're like, yeah, that visit from his parents is going to be rough. And Chimney is feeling a little in the hot seat, you know? So while everybody is speculating about, like, what could the Buckley parents be like? Like, Maddie and Buck, they're so different. Like, there's got to be a story there. And Chimney's like, you have no idea. So he's, again,
like, Chimney, clearly, keep your dumb whore mouth shut.
Yeah, it kind of seems like he's not even trying. He is very much, he even starts saying, he's like, kind of just saying this inscrutable stuff. He's like, if we all knew what we all know, then we would all know, and we would know, or something. And everybody's like, don't really know how to parse that.
And then, like brother, he, everyone's looking at him, and he's like, oh my God, I'm gonna blow it. And so he also runs away down the fire pole. He fire poles away.
I'm so glad you said like brother, because I think while watching it, it didn't even really like occur to me that, yeah, we just see both of them in consecutive scenes do the exact same thing. It's
cute. And it's enough to like give everyone in the station the ick to the point where they're like, you know, I don't want to know, actually.
Yeah, like it's fine.
It's fine. This is, you know, not my circus, not my monkeys. It's whatever.
Right.
And so then we go from that to a scene starring recently
disgraced former actor. Sorry.
And his TV daughter.
Yeah, no, that was like my big note for this scene is like, man, I kind of can't look at Michael the same anymore. And we already weren't big fans of Michael, but now it's like, it's just looming over it in more of a way than it was before. But yes, it's May is at Michael's house. They're like having dinner or something. And she's recounting this story of this call that she had with Karen, Delia, Melissa, whatever her name is. And she's like, yeah, you know, it started out as just this normal thing. And then she got shot and died. And Michael's like, she died right there on the phone with you. And we get that this is kind of May's first experience, kind of like we've seen a lot of characters go through on the show. This is kind of her first experience as some sort of first responder, losing someone essentially. And it's kind of haunting her.
Very much so. And Michael, he starts to do that sort of concerned dad thing. He's like, oh yeah, should I be worried that my daughter heard her first homicide? First of all, is that something every dad prepares for?
Presumably.
And second of all, May has a very funny response to this. She's like, no, I need help. It's time for you to dad up.
Right. And he's so just like,
he's putting on his dad hat, you know?
Yeah. What
he's
does
like,
that
whatever.
Even mean?
He asks for advice, you know, cause even though Michael was never a first responder, he was married to Athena for so long. And, he kind of gives her like a piece of advice that like is true, but also very unhelpful in the moment, which is that, you know, Athena.
He's like, just remember, never get vaccinated. Whatever you do.
They put the chemicals in there that turn the frogs
God
autistic.
God doesn't want you to poison your body with the COVID vaccine. She's like, Dad, where's all this coming from?
And by the way, I got some synthetic estrogen for you to keep the... your
I bought you some steroids to keep you on top of the job.
Right. So he mentions that Athena never, you know, talked to him about that sort of thing because she never brought the job home with her. She always had a very clear, and we've known this about Athena, she always has a very clear cutoff of like what is the job and what is her life, and it's based around the uniform, right? So when she takes the uniform off, she leaves the job behind. And May's like, I only got a polo, you know, it's it's not the same. You know, I don't wear a flak jacket at my desk. And so it's like, well, maybe I'll just have to ask Athena. Speaking of Athena Brizio moment, Athena Brizio moment, because Melissa. Fabthena moment. Because, you know, they're going over the case. They're going over the case. Turns out Melissa the Karen was at war with the entire cul-de-sac. She was launching a one-woman crusade against the the undesirables of her neighborhood, which apparently included a poor, like, 7-year-old girl running a lemonade stand out of her front yard, which apparently didn't meet city standards.
Being like, do you have a permit to be running a small business or something? It's really like an Agatha Christie situation where, like, everybody who knew her had a motive. We've got, like, this gay couple who were at war with her because they had this little dog who would, like, whatever, run over to her yard, dig in her yard. And apparently she poisoned the dog.
She poisoned the fucking dog. There's another couple. They're immediately presented as the only ones who managed to achieve an uneasy peace with the Karen. Mm-hmm. It, you know, later turns out to be a lot more complicated. There's an interesting dichotomy because, like, everyone else she terrorizes is black, and this family that achieves the uneasy peace with her is, like, a white family or, like, a white couple.
That is true.
So that adds to the sort of racist undertones of this character.
Right, but she's dead, so we don't have to unpack all that, I guess.
Exactly. It died with her. the peace was brokered over a loaf of zucchini bread, which I just gotta say, like, I've never had zucchini bread. It sounds fucking awful. It sounds disgusting.
Oh, it's just like banana bread.
No, it's not just like banana bread. Bananas and zucchinis are different things.
I don't really know who made the decision to, like, start putting zucchini in bread, but, you know, it's fine. It tastes fine. The wife of this couple has, like, taken up baking during COVID, as many of us did.
Sourdough was too complicated for her, apparently, so she defected to the zucchini bread battalion.
Wow, what a coward.
TikTok, I suppose. Yeah, what a coward. What a little idiot. More on that later. It's a total Agatha Christie. Murder on the Orient Express mentioned. Fabrizio just straight up says,
"What if they all did it?
What if they all did it? Everyone, it's Scream. Everyone's a suspect." So we cut away from that to Buck, you know, fucking breaking in the whole fucking liquor store. Brought so much wine and two whole bottles of tequila that apparently are both for Chimney. And they're nice tequila too. I think he got it's not Casamigos, it's Don. I think he got two bottles of Don Julio, which is, like, expensive tequila.
Yeah, and it's also like, Chimney, are you gonna drink both of those tonight? Do we need to have a talk about this, Chimney?
I wouldn't put it past him, you know? I would not put it past that man for the fucking situation they're about to get themselves in. Albert gets on Chimney's ass about wearing jeans, and Buck immediately is like, "What about dinner? What about dinner?" And Albert gets back to work. He is tense, okay? This is a tense situation.
But kind of once again implies that Buck and Albert are in some sort of codependent, possibly romantic sexual relationship. Because, like, why is that his housewife?
I like the idea that... never mind, I'm not going to say that. There's a knock on the door. And, who should show up? But it's Mr. and Mrs. Buckley. But they brought gifts!
Yes, arms laden with baby presents. And immediately it starts to, like, they start their needling. You know, Chimney introduces himself right as Howard Hahn. And as they see Buck, they're like, "Oh, they're still calling you Buck or whatever." And it kind of comes up that they don't like nicknames. And then there's an interesting reveal where Chimney's like, "What about Maddie?" And she's like, "That's the name on my birth certificate." So she her legal full name is Maddie Buckley, not like Madeline or anything.
Maddie Buckley. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's her legal full name.
First name Maddie, middle name Maddie.
And then they ask Howard, do people call you Howard? And he's like,
"Yeah.
Yep. We get a little moment as they're walking them inside indoors or whatever. You know, Buck and Maddie are like, "United Front, United Front," because they're presenting a United Front to their fucking parents.
And they like link their pinkies. It's so cute. It's so emotional.
It's so cute. This is like, okay, so we've had have had moments on this podcast in the past where we've been like, siblings, I'm not sure. You know what I mean? Because there is a like an obvious disconnect in terms of age and also physical appearance between the two. And like there are moments that like make it clear that they are siblings and they behave like siblings, etc. Mm-hmm. But they're also very different people. And they run in different circles, etc. And this episode sold me so hard on Buck and Maddie sibling dynamic, because there is sort of a missing link just in general episodes between the two, and mm-hmm. here we have that missing link in full view, which is the parents, right? Yeah. It's not because they react to their parents like so similarly in different nuanced ways, but like the effect is very familiar and shared between the two of them. So I found mm-hmm. that right off the bat very, very believable. Yeah. Poor Buck is getting the needles more than anyone. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. They're distributing them evenly. They're just also giving Maddie gifts, so it hurts even more.
Yeah, they we hear that they drove in an RV to LA because, you know, COVID. They decided they didn't want to take a plane or a train or anything.
Because Maddie's apparently a high-risk pregnancy.
Oh my god, yeah. They fucking neg their own daughter for having a geriatric pregnancy, which is so crazy. Especially yeah. when, like, it's crazy for, like, your parents who are old to, like, make fun of you for being old, first yeah. of all. Mm-hmm. And also, like, the casting of Dee Wallace, you're like, okay, you must have been pretty old when you had Buck.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. it's like, you know, Buck wasn't calling, saying you had a high risk pregnancy. It's just like so out of pocket. It's insane.
And there's something so like insidious about these two, which is that they don't mean to needle their kids in this way.
Yeah, it's and just that like becomes their natural so clear state of over being. The episode.
Exactly, exactly. So she's probably like thinking she's relating to Maddie. She's probably thinking like, yeah, I'm talking from experience. I had Buck when I was older. And so I'm taking the steps, and Maddie's just feeling the full force of it, like. And then the needling it gets even worse.
It kind of goes from needling to like straight up just saying extremely offensive things, because you mm-hmm. know, they say like, we're just so glad like you're at this point, and Buck's like, yeah, with the right guy, and Dad is like, yeah, God knows it wasn't Doug. And it's like, oh yeah, let's just bring up the horribly abusive husband that had a violent, you know, horrific showdown with Maddie where she was forced to kill him like a year mm-hmm. or two ago. Let's yeah. bring that up at our pleasant family dinner. Because why not,
right? You know, it's just a light, happy, jokey time with the family. We can all laugh about it now. Time has passed. Maddie does not take it well. Then they jump right from that to so Buck, Maddie tells us you're seeing a therapist.
Right, totally outing Maddie for having talked about it with their parents. They're clearly trying to be like, so are you like crazy or what? mm-hmm. But interestingly, they mentioned that they went to see a therapist together when Maddie's Doug situation happened. And Maddie's like, interesting, you went to see a therapist for my problems, which is interesting.
The fucking the wounded child in Jennifer Love Hewitt's eyes yes. is like, it's so poignant, like, and like it's so like palpable, like you really like identify with her so strongly in this scene, and you feel like all of the hurt that just comes mm-hmm. through with everything. Everything they say is just a knife, you know, it's a knife.
There's
blend.
A great exchange where their dad is like, well, like, you know, we had to find out Doug was dead from Buck, and Buck's like, yeah, I didn't from want you Evan. To find out on Dateline.
They're calling him Evan the entire scene, of course.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's just immediately, it's getting so tense. And the parents are completely oblivious to it, obviously, because this is their natural state of being. Mm-hmm. And everyone's getting so uncomfortable. Chimney, like, goes to, like, refill their plates or whatever, or their drinks or something. Mm-hmm.
Albert's like, I'll help. And then Buck is also like, I'll help. All three of us have to go refill one wine glass right now. And yeah, as soon as they're alone, the Buckley parents are like, wow, like, Evan seems good. You know, I don't know what I was expecting, but he seems fine. And Maddie is like, yeah, I think he's good at like acting like he's fine, but mm-hmm. maybe that's not what's actually going on.
Yeah.
And that's where we leave them for now.
Just very, very pointedly just going, hey guys, you have a son, pay attention to him. Etc.
Yeah, don't just believe him when he says things are good when he's not acting that way.
Yeah, but we go back to that. We go back to Fabrice Athena.
Yes.
You know, getting an update on Gina's house at the police station. Someone apparently ransacked the place.
Mm-hmm.
They ransacked, and there's more because there's a white powder residue all over the crime scene. Not the kind.
And immediately
you think.
You're like, oh, Coke is involved.
Bumping that.
But no, apparently it was flour.
Flour. Yes, it was flour because it smells like fucking zucchini bread.
That was such a funny detail in there. Is he's like, it smelled like sourdough. I was like, no fucking way would you be able to detect the hint of sourdough smell in the flour that was
sourdough
left
is very distinctive. It is a very distinctive
scent.
Yeah,
but it's not in the flour. It's in the sourdough starter, like the sourdough essence.
I love the idea that she was like in the middle of like trying again with the sourdough. And she's like, wait, I forgot to ransack that house.
I forgot I was going to ransack her house. And also, I'm obsessed with the implication that Fabrizio is like such a perceptive, either perceptive smeller or like perhaps a baker himself, and was like, yeah, I would know the smell of sourdough flour anywhere.
Hey, he's Italian. What
True.
Are you gonna do?
True.
Forget about it. She wasn't there to, I don't know, get drugs or whatever. No, she was looking for something else. and so it turns out there's a name that is not attached to anyone in the neighborhood on paper in the mail that Melissa stole, right?
Mm-hmm.
It turns out it's some lady who's in the system for identity theft, other things.
And oh yeah, bigamy.
Bigamy. She's in the system. They pull up her face. It's the white neighbor.
Yes. It's like Rita is not Rita. And Delia knew that, and she had the evidence to prove it. So now Rita, this I guess white woman is how we're identifying her. She has a motive, right? She was trying to cover up her history of crimes from the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. And there's like a soft implication that there may have been, you know, more tension between them that we get into more later. Not that kind of tension, like, you know, financial tension.
But who knows?
And so they show up to Rita's house and arrest her for the murder of her neighbor who went on to star in Abbott Elementary. Mm-hmm. And they say, we found out about your ex-husband. We found out about your other husband. Mm-hmm. And she goes, you found out about Marshall? We thought his name was Jerome. Oh. I forgot about that one, etc.
No, she's like, oh, damn it, you know about him too. So this lady, she doesn't just have one secret husband. She had two secret husbands. This is so juicy. Like, I love
it's
this
so
part
good.
Of the storyline.
It's so good. And then they find the gun. They find the gun.
Yes.
And so it's like, obviously, it's like, okay, so she killed, you know, whoever for, you know,
that's
extorting
certainly what
her.
It's looking
or.
Like.
Yeah, that's what it's looking like. But you know, before we can you know get more into the case
mm-hmm.
of this woman's murder,
yes,
it's just so absurd to me that like this is the comedy like C plot
yeah,
of the episode.
This woman's very lighthearted, goofy murder,
which it is, because you're immediately supposed to dislike her, and you're like, well, guess the world's a better place.
Yeah, good riddance.
May shows up at Bethina's hoping to talk to Mom, and instead she finds Stepdad. Bobby is the only one home, and so they're gonna have a little heart-to-heart themselves. May asks him about, you know, the sort of the thing that she's, you know, struggling with, which is sort of compartmentalizing in the way that Athena is so capable of doing. Right. And Bobby sort of relates to her on this front because honestly, he's never been that good at it either. It's something that he struggled with a lot in the past. That's why he was self-medicating so hard with specifically vodka and Percocet.
He's such a party girl. I'm sorry.
He is. He should be at the club.
With his sobriety. But like in theory, just something about him mentioning vodka and Percocet, I'm like, oh my God, I feel like I'm listening to a Charlie XCX song or something.
Right. And it's like, it's so interesting because like back in like Bobby Begins Again or whatever, they were like, what are you on? He's like, everything.
Everything.
That's two things.
That's two things. I guess maybe he just didn't want to list like the 30 drugs he was taking.
So May, let's talk about my experiences with heroin, ketamine, and crack cocaine.
It just turns into like a scared straight thing.
Yeah. And she's like, wow, I'm not going to do that. And he's like, good. It's a very good scene because he's sort of providing her with an example of, you know, what not to do. But she's like, you have to have found some other way. I mean, you've been doing this for so... She calls him old. She calls him old.
Yeah.
Unk, you know. She calls him old and he's like, yep, I am, etc. But he gives her a little, you know, piece of advice that, you know, you have to find your own way of dealing with it. It doesn't have to look like anyone else's or everyone else's. It just has to work for you. And don't get down on yourself for feeling remorse about, you know, sort of that question of like, what if I had done this differently? What if this had gone a different way, or I had been faster on this, or I had sent these cops out to this location? Because that remorse just means that you care, you know?
Yeah.
And that's actually a good thing, right?
Yeah, I thought that was a very poignant thing.
Yeah. And she seems to kind of find comfort in this and, you know, almost take it in stride in a sense, because she shows up to work the next day. And guess who graduated from training?
Yeah. Josh is like, guess what? You get to sit at the big girl desk today.
And she does. She's like, but what about that call where the lady died? And he was like, you did everything right. Sometimes people just die.
Yeah, it's not like she shot her.
That would be the twist. That would be the Agatha Christie twist. May had the gun, shot her through the phone, and we didn't even see. And you never suspected a thing.
She sits down
and she gets a series of, you know, funny dud calls. You know, this guy meant to call 811 about his gas pipe or whatever. This woman, you know, she's, you know, like they gave me a ticket for my meter. And she's like, is your meter expired? Like, the funniest, this guy goes, I'm telling you, my freaking roommate stole all my drugs. And she goes, yeah. I really don't think you thought this call through, and then disconnects.
Damn. So I guess he'll never get recourse for having all his drugs stolen.
Exactly. You know, he could sue like Rossman Dunbar.
He should. That always works out well. But yeah, then she takes a call from somebody named Stan, and he's got kind of a creepy tone, and he starts like asking her riddles. He's like, do you know why people lie? You know, they say they care, but they don't. They ask you how you are and you just have to say that you're fine, but you're not really fine. So something clearly is going on here. She like calls Josh over. This guy starts saying like, I'm going to teach him a lesson. I'm going to blow their lying heads right off. So it kind of sounds like this guy's planning to commit some horrible act of violence as revenge for the perceived wrongs in his life. So Josh gets on the phone. They're trying to be like, what are you planning to do, Stan? And he's like, I have a bomb.
I'm going to do a little terrorism, a little unibombing. It's going to be Oklahoma City up in this piece. And it turns out, you know, he's going to blow up his former place of work. question mark.
Yeah. Because... Well, at first they think it's like the place he just got fired from.
Yeah, but then he just got fired.
They check out that place and like there's no bomb and there's no Stan. And they end up going through his list of, apparently he's been fired. He has a long history.
No, this is a Gen Z moment. Gen Z moment. The first thing May does after taking this call is says, let me find him on Instagram and see what's up. And it turns out this man posts incessantly about all the jobs he loses because he's just so unhirable now that he was fired from his position of 20 years or something. And so it's like, well, he was first fired 2.5 years ago, and that seemed to set this chain in motion. And that's probably the one he's the most sort of bereaved about. So what was that company that he worked for? Smash cut to like, you know, fire trucks and, you know, bomb squad rolling up to this building in downtown LA. This woman who, you know, may or may not have been the one to fire him is in complete disbelief. Turns out Stanley Whitworth was fired because he experienced an injury on the job. He was the demo man for this construction company, question mark.
To be fair, that is a risky line of work.
It is a risky line of work.
I bomb things for a living.
He blamed corporate cost cutting for the injury, and they rejected it. Went to court or something, and it was found in favor of the company. Huge if true.
And that's kind of a theme of this episode and week, it seems
that way. And he was fired and he lost his pension despite having worked there for 20 years. So that's obviously
This guy sounds like he has more of a real injustice done to him than Rockman
it Dunbar. Really does. It really makes you feel for Stan, honestly. Like, I know he's a terrorist. I know terrorism is bad. But, like, honestly, and I have to be very careful with how I word this because this is a public podcast. But I was kind of rooting for the terrorist.
No, you're not saying you would go out and bomb your former employer. It's just that, well, I mean, I won't put words in your mouth, but it's just that
I was about to say,
don't speak for me, you know, but it is true that when these things happen, you know, your job very much can wrong you in these situations. Yeah. Sounds like Stan was not unionized. And that should have been the message of this episode, is after they clear the whole thing up, Chimney should have been like, here, this is the card for the demolition workers union. Maybe they have a cute logo with like a guy exploding a bomb. And, he finds his purpose in labor organizing. Chimney gets word that supposedly there's a janitor inside the building having an asthma attack. So they're like, Chimney, get in there, see if you can find this guy, get him out. He runs in. Eddie is like casing the joint. He's like, did you find the asthma guy yet? And he says, no, but like, you know, I'll check the garage or whatever. So Chimney goes down and he finds this janitor, right? A guy in a janitor outfit having trouble breathing. He starts to get to work on him. And then, he notices this guy has his finger on a detonator. This guy is holding some sort of improvised detonation device for a giant bomb. It's Stan.
Wait, hold on. Didn't he say he was going to the garage?
I think so.
What is he doing in the boiler room?
I guess they couldn't source a garage for this scene.
Right. But it does call to mind. Do you remember pre-9/11, that 9/11 terror attack that wasn't 9/11, where it was like the bombs in the garage in like the base of the World Trade Center in the 90s or something?
Yeah.
That's a thing that happened, right? That wasn't just Fight Club.
Yeah. I mean, I don't like remember it because I wasn't born yet, because we're so young and youthful.
Jane. If there's one thing to learn from Buck, it's that there was a world before we were born.
I thought what we were supposed to learn from him is that there wasn't. Whatever. Anyway, yeah. Are you saying it was that kind of thing?
It's giving that kind of thing.
It's giving the less famous World Trade Center bombing.
I will say diversity win, because Stan is out here proving that asthmatics can be terrorists too. And that's important representation.
Loved about this scene is that Stan is apparently a deranged revenge bomber, you know, domestic terrorist, but still has the courtesy to wear a mask during the pandemic. And
period.
You know, we should all be
period.
More like him.
We should all be more like Stan the terrorist. FBI agent.
I would love it if we could call the episode that, but I think it might get us flagged in some way. But back outside, they're like trying to radio Chimney. They're like, Chimney, what's going on? Come in. And he can't. Chimney starts trying to kind of negotiate with this guy. And he's pretty good at this, it turns out. Stan starts talking about his grievance, you could say. Remember the title of the episode. He's like, I gave these guys 20 years of my life or whatever. Who should barge in rudely? but Eddie, who's like, hey, didn't you hear on the radio? Like, the squad's moving out. And Jimmy's like, just give me a minute. Like, it's fine. And Eddie notices that Chimney is standing opposite the bomber. And Chimney's like, yeah, just move out. Get everybody out. And Eddie is like, I'll let Cap know. And he runs back outside. So now the team has been alerted. Eddie runs out. He's like, Chin's in there with the bomber. The call is coming from inside the house. And once again, Chimney is now doing masterful negotiation with Stan.
He is good at this, I will say. He's really good at this. In another life, he would be an excellent hostage negotiator. Did you ever, sorry, not to pull us on a tangent, but we are making good time. Did you ever see Best in Show, the Christopher Guest mockumentary?
A long time ago, though.
Did you remember like when they stop to like visit like Catherine O'Hara's ex-boyfriend in his home with his family, and he's like, "I'm a hostage negotiator." And here's the thing: they don't tell you. They all jump, right? Or like his job is like talking people down, and then his son. Like kidnaps the dog and is sitting on top of the shed, and he goes, I will gouge your eye out with my thumb. I shit you not, you little freak. I was like, Chimney's like the opposite of that. Chimney's like the yang to that guy's yin. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Chimney is being pretty effective. He kind of lets the guy air his grievances. But his asthma, he actually does have asthma, and it's getting worse. Chimney's kind of trying to...
He's born with it.
Well, yeah.
Allegedly.
And Chimney's trying to ask if he wants the inhaler, and he pulls down his mask and he you know, tries to relate emotionally. He's like, you think I don't know what it's like to be harboring all these things, to be a ticking time bomb, you know,
not be able
to tell the truth? Let me tell you.
You know, Eddie's outside catching his breath. He's so out of shape. It's ridiculous. Like you know, catching,
ever since he left that illegal underground fight club, he's just not keeping up with his...
Which also gets a callback in this episode later on.
Yes.
But then we immediately cut back to Chimney, and he's Wendy Williams doing Hot Topics. You know, he's telling Stan all about this. It's offloading everything onto this guy. And Stan is invested.
Yes. It's hilarious. Chimney's first instinct in this situation was, finally, someone to tell my terrible secret to unburden myself. And yeah, Stan is eating it up like it's, you know, gossip. He is the queen of gossip. He's like, really? What is the sister? You know, what does everybody think about this? Like, it's... He's very invested in the Buffy
drama. It's a fucking Family
Guy
cutaway gag is what it feels like. This show is a sitcom, okay? This show is a fucking sitcom with like a dramatic frame.
Like outside, they're all like, oh, I guess Chimney's probably talking him down. Like that's why he hasn't come out yet. And Buck is like, what do you think they're talking about? We cut back to them talking about Buck. And, you know, we hear like Buck was just a little kid when this whole thing started. And, you know, there's a big age gap between him and his sister, and Stan asks, are you sure you want to be a part of this family? And Chimney's like, you know, Maddie's great, I'm looking forward to being a dad, but I've just got to make it through this dinner with the parents. Mm-hmm. And Stan mm-hmm. is like, you're doing another family gathering? Again, he's so into it.
He's so into it. And it's this gossip session. It's mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's hot topics that sort of brings Stan back to reality in this moment. And Chimney like seizes the moment to say, are you sure you don't want the inhaler?
Yeah.
Like let me give you a hand here. Right? And he has the air canister in one hand and the inhaler in the other. And as Stan takes the inhaler, Chimney rips the fucking detonator out of the guy's hand and smashes his head in with the air canister. He's so that video of that girl going, I have the mind of a master, like the mind of a master. What is that? I don't know, but I'm so creative like that.
I don't know what you're referencing, but everything. This is like a really skilled, heroic thing that Chimney just pulls out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm. This is something he would lie about in season one to get Tatiana to sleep with him.
And
that is character development.
How far he's come. Yeah.
How far he's come. And so they get, you know, the Unabomber out of the basement and mm-hmm. onto a stretcher. And he's sort
and
of
immediately he's like, oh my
conscious.
God, Evan Buckley, I'm your biggest fan.
I'm your
he's
biggest
like,
fan. I
he
heard
realizes,
all about you.
Yeah, he's like, oh, that must be Buck. Like, you weren't lying. This story's real. And Buck's like, what happened? What are you talking about? But Chimney manages to crowd the guy into the ambulance before he can really
it's like,
spill.
Oh, that O2 is kicking in. That O2 is kicking in. And that's the end of that. But back at the fire station, who mm-hmm. should suspect a thing but one Henrietta Wilson? Of course, the noticer.
Yes.
Hashtag noticing. Henrietta Wilson comes up to Chim and she's like, so that Unabomber, huh? And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. She's like, so the secret has to do with Buck. He's mm-hmm. like, I'm sorry I didn't tell you. I'm sorry I told the Unabomber instead. And she's like, no, I'm impressed. I am impressed that you managed to keep a secret. That is growth. That is character development right there.
Right. Even though he has not really done a very good job of keeping the secret.
No. He's certainly let it slip that he has a secret. And he did tell everything to that guy who is just saddled up in a hospital bed waiting to be taken to jail, presumably, for... Mm-hmm. attempted terrorism and mass casualty, etc. Prison for life, I suppose. Chimney asks Hen, you know, is it ever, you know, reasonable, is it ever okay to keep a secret from someone you love that you know you would hurt them? And she says, you know, something very deeply unhelpful, which is depends on what the secret is and why you're keeping it. You know?
Yeah. He's like, okay, I already knew that, but thanks.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Hen. And then she goes about the rest of her shift.
What should I have for dinner? Depends on what food you have and what you're in the mood for.
But he does say something poignant here, which is, you know, Buck, I mean, it's deeply sad, which is, yes. you know, it'll give clarity to, you know, the reason why Buck feels alone. It's because he has been alone, because everyone's been keeping this from him. Like, for God's sakes, his loneliness was correct. You know?
He was the only one not in on this thing.
It's like the one time a man with a conspiracy board was right. And he didn't even have one.
But Hen ends the scene by being like, for the record, I'm not in on it either. Like, whatever it is, I want no part of it.
And probably smart. Honestly, that would be how I react. Like, as much as I do love juicy gossip, if it is something this serious that is eating someone mm-hmm. up inside, I would probably be like, you know, don't tell me.
Yeah.
I don't need this in my brain. It's fine.
But we go back to our silly and goofy murder plotline. And Fabthina are interrogating Rita / whatever her real name is at the station. Mm-hmm. She opens this scene with an absolute banger of a line, all-timer of a line. She says, yes, I was married to three men at once. And yes, I ransacked Delia's house, but I didn't kill her.
admits to every single crime that she is being charged with, except the murder. A strong case, queen.
I don't really get bigamy unless you're like Mormon and you're like, you have all your wives in the same house. Like you're, because Rita does not appear to be like doing polygamy in the sense that she like has multiple partners at home that she's married to. She just like married a guy and then married another guy without getting a divorce and then married another guy without getting a divorce. And I'm not saying it's easy to get a divorce, but it's like, there was nothing stopping her from just ending those marriages before starting new ones.
Well, that's an involved process, I guess. She would have to explain it to the guys, you know, and then get them to sign the papers, unless she asked for an annulment.
Yeah, the implication is that she was, like, conning them for money and stuff, so I guess maybe she just, like, disappears and burns the bridges.
That, well, it would probably make the marriages, like, legally, you know, like, void, right? Like,
maybe.
She could probably ask for an annulment, you know, but then she would have to confess to these crimes that she did. And so okay. I was looking up the difference between bigamy and polygamy, because I did not know. And bigamy is apparently the act of marrying a second person while still legally married to another, you know, involving sort of deceitful methods, versus polygamy, which is, you know, more of like, It's less of a legal term. It's more of like a social practice about having multiple spouses with them all knowing about each other. And
that makes sense.
So I guess they're both illegal, but bigamy is the one that you can be charged with because it's more of a legal. I'm not a lawyer. This is just my skimming of, you know, the Google search results, right? Apparently she seems to know her rights and how to make her case scores because she was a lawyer in a past life, allegedly.
You have to be if you're going to marry multiple people illegally.
Right. And she was getting away with it for a while. That's the thing. She was baking that zucchini bread. She had everybody fooled. except. Okay. So the thing is, Melissa was blackmailing her ass because she stole her mail. And this is where like the real like censure for like she would definitely go away for this in real life whether she did it or not. She was also extorting money from her to keep her, you know, secret a secret, right?
Yeah, it's like Rita did illegal things, but Delia was pretty squarely in the wrong as well.
Yeah. And like there was a genuine standoff where Rita or whatever her name is came to Melissa's door with the gun and pointed it right at her face and was like, I'm not giving you any more. And okay, this is why you don't mess with a bitch from Philly, because she stood right up to her and said, what, you're going to shoot me in full, like, you know, audible view of our neighborhood, etc., and ripped the gun from her hands and told her to fuck off.
Yeah.
I would have moved. I would have been so humiliated.
Yeah, no, this is crazy. And it's kind of just this whole drawn out convoluted thing of like Delia then had the gun and
that's why it was her gun. It was Rita's gun.
Yeah, got shot with the gun, but Rita says she doesn't know how, but she knew that it was with her gun, so she like snuck over there and used the dog's fetch stick thing to get the gun back over to her side, and it's like a whole thing. But she claims she still doesn't know how or who shot Delia. She just knows that it was her gun and she got her gun out from the yard, which does sound like a pretty unconvincing story. But Fabrizio admits to Athena, you know, I believe her. And before they finish the interrogation, he checks her fingers. He asks to see her hands. And when he asks Athena why she had him do that, she's like, there was a bit of fingernail on the gun that apparently belonged to Delia, or there was, I don't know, they knew who it belonged to, but you know, it apparently did not belong to Rita. So,
well, Hen noticed that her fingernail like was chipped off and she had like manicured hands, right? Yeah. And the chipped nail was caught in the gun slide.
Right. So this occurs to Athena at the end of the scene. She's like, Rita didn't have all her nails.
Mm-hmm.
So they go back to the scene of the crime.
It turns out, listen, remember when Fabrizio tripped over that gnome Turns out everyone in the neighborhood has an alibi. Everyone was accounted for on that afternoon, except for one. Except for one. Because as they're researching the place, who should prance into Gina, Melissa, whatever her fucking name is, backyard, but the dog. It's the dog.
The corgi. They realize that the sequence of events they reconstruct is the corgi came into the yard. That's why she said on the phone, she's like, "You, what are you doing here?" Then she tripped over a garden gnome, accidentally shot herself, and died.
No one.
So I guess that's what happened.
No one is doing it like this show. No. Name another show that's doing it like this one. There isn't one.
What's great is like how much speculation they have to do to come to this conclusion. Like when you think about it, this could easily not be what happened, right?
Yeah.
Like there's really not that much evidence that this is what went down. It almost feels like they're just trying to like take the easy way out and get this case wrapped up. And they're like, yeah, it was probably like the dog surprised her. And then
and what jury would convict
though.
That face? Look at the little face.
Yeah, they say no jury will convict this corgi, which is good because that would have been depressing if like Athena in her typical cop way is like, well, the law's the law. She takes out like a little mini pair of handcuffs and puts them on the corgi.
We get a scene of like a victim impact statement of like, you know, Delia's sister on the stand while the corgi is there in a suit at the fucking defense table.
The corgi like wipes a tear away from its eye.
Listening to this emotional
beat. We see members
beat.
Of the jury like glare at the corgi.
But it's all over in like 51 seconds, right? Of course, because we have to wrap this shit up and it's the last episode of the season. Yes.
Yes.
But dramatic music is still playing, of course. And so, case closed. Dog did it. She did it to herself. Accidental shooting in her own chest. She's dead. Hooray. Everybody clapped. Now, back to the actual emotional part of the episode.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay, so
Buckley parents are back.
Mm-hmm.
We're all eating dinner.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're commenting on how dangerous everybody's jobs are. They're commenting specifically about the bomb situation. And Chimney's like, you know, Stan wasn't a bad guy. He probably wasn't even planning to blow up the place for real. And the Buckley dad is like, still pretty risky. From what I've heard, Evan has spent a lot of time in hospitals. And
from
Buck is
what
like, from what you
I've heard.
Hear. Yeah, this is when it really hits you. It is absolutely crazy that the Buckley parents didn't visit Buck in the hospital once when his leg got fucking crushed by a fire truck. Now, I have to say, obviously, that's what happened, like, canonically, is that they just didn't visit. I think it's more like, you know, they didn't know they were going to have parents for Buck and Maddie in season two. And, they didn't think to like have them. They hadn't cast those actors yet. I don't know. It almost feels like, you know, in real life, this would not happen. Like that, of course your parents could be estranged enough that they don't visit you in the hospital, but like their relationship with their parents seems to be not very close, but like they are still their parents and like put on the airs of like being their parents. And I don't know this. I don't know what I'm trying to express here. Just that basically, yes, technically in canon, they didn't show up by his side even once. But it kind of feels like they're almost retconning that a little bit. Like prior to this, I would have just assumed that they did show up once or twice off screen. But canonically, they didn't visit him. So that's what matters. And that's bad.
I would agree with that more so, but they do have their own internal logic with it that it makes it all the richer and juicier, which is that, you know, his mom takes a very victimhood approach to his own hospitalization and Maddie's hospitalization, yeah. Which is that it's not just that she doesn't like hospitals, it's that she doesn't like seeing her kids in hospitals, and that apparently outweighs the need to visit her kids in the hospital.
Yeah, it's like nobody likes seeing their kids in hospitals, but you know who probably has a worse time is your kids who are in the hospital.
Right. And so it's like, that was what made it work for me. Because I otherwise, yeah, I would probably jump to that same thing.
I just
thing.
Was like talking, you know.
But these narcissistic ass parents, they ask Chimney to go and grab the other box that that they got to sort of, I guess, lighten the mood. And Maggie's like, more gifts? Really? And they're like, not quite. turns out. Oh, and we also get another offhand Doug mention, kind of. But turns out they brought Maddie's baby box. Okay, so I didn't know this was a thing. So
yeah, I didn't have this shit.
I didn't have this shit either. But apparently a lot of families will make a little box of like a baby's belongings, etc. I don't know. We just threw ours in bins. I don't even know if
baby
we have
mementos.
Most of our stuff.
Yeah, we had like, you know,
we had baby pictures,
photos and stuff. Yeah, but
yeah, we had baby. My sister and I had books.
Certainly, you know? No like hand carved mahogany box with your name engraved into it that has your little baby booties and the selected pictures. But anyway, Maddie opens it. She's like,
"Well, hold on, because it seems to be a surprise to not just us as viewers, but also to the other child in the room."
Well, yes, right? That's the crux of the scene. Is Buck is like, "Oh, cool. When do I get mine?" And kind of silence from the parents. And Chimney tries to lighten the mood. He's like, hey, you haven't even grown up yet. Like, you know, it's too early for that. But Buck, mm-hmm. you kind of see it dawn on his face. He's like, do I not have one of these? And that's crazy. Right?
That's crazy.
That is crazy. So immediately we're like, why do they just like not like Buck as much as their other child?
Right.
And then they start like negging Maddie some more. They start saying like, we never gave up hope that you'd come to your senses about Doug, and you did. And then Buck is like, fuck this. I'm not going to take it anymore. he starts. I really liked this, how he just decides to like stand up for Maddie. Cause obviously like Maddie yeah. wants to keep the peace, but it's like, they have been being so cruel about her life in general. And I like that yeah. Buck was like, let me, it's not even coming from this place of him wanting to defend himself. He spends the scene like defending Maddie specifically. And he's like, you guys basically cut her off when she married Doug. And
like
you know,
didn't
I don't
even
care
go to the wedding.
You, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, sure. He turned out to be a bad guy, but like, it wasn't your job to just like cut her off because you thought she was making a bad decision. It was like you had to support her through that and you yeah. didn't.
And you know, they start getting very defensive about it, and he just has this moment of like, I'm fucking done. Like I'm an adult. I don't have to fucking deal with this. He stands up and he delivers a monologue that has been seen in TikTok edits all around the world, of course.
Yes.
History
was
made. You know,
where
he just starts fucking tearing into them about, why am I not enough for you guys? You were never there for me or for her.
The parents are like, you didn't make it easy for us.
No, that and line is the fucking craziest part to me. Like that's the one
crazy.
That like fucking hits the hardest.
This
for
is
me.
Definitely a type of parent that will think like that think their children owe them something when in reality yeah. like everything is things that they owe to their children. And Maddie finally speaks up and is like, we were supposed to make it easy for you. We were kids. You were our parents.
Yeah.
And Buck is like, you want to know why I'm really in therapy? Because I've spent my entire life feeling like a constant disappointment. It's like, damn. Yeah. He's really.
My job is dangerous. I have
walked through fire
day of my life because of you.
Okay. Can I just say the delivery of I have walked through fire is the spiritual sister to I live in a freaking little storage closet. And I will be making that edit and putting it on Twitter.
Oh my God, please. I like to think of it as the good version, whereas that's the...
Oh yeah, yeah. The performance is much better, but the cadence is technically similar.
I would agree with that. And, you know, the parents, they're like, what were we supposed to do? You know, like, if we're such failures, then what mm-hmm. were we supposed to fucking do? And he Buck says, of course, that iconic line.
Famous, heartbreaking line, love me anyway. And it's like, yeah.
So this scene, I actually found this scene to be very, like, personally upsetting because it was just so familiar. And I was like, it was the good kind of upsetting. You know what I mean? It was like a mm-hmm. cathartic upsetting where I was extremely, like, you know, sort of, I was honestly taken aback by how well done it was. And it was so believable. This dynamic and sort of even if the writing was, you know, melodramatic in the way that the show is, it still yeah. had a very strong emotional core that felt very real. I definitely teared up in this scene. I was feeling so strongly for both Buck and Maddie. I was feeling exactly like them in that scene. And it was very real and very raw. And I have nothing but praise to heap on this scene. It's not that common in network TV to see this kind of relationship dynamic between, you know, parents and their kids play out so with such a strong perspective towards the kids in a way that mm-hmm. doesn't feel like ham-fisted or like fix it style. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
You know what I was reminded of? Because, you know, it was so specific that it kind of felt like it was perhaps, I mean, not to psychoanalyze anyone, but it felt like it was perhaps taken from the personal experience of either the writer of this episode or the writer of one of these episodes, right? And I was reminded of that episode of Dr. Odyssey that made me stop watching Dr. Odyssey. I couldn't tell you exactly what episode it was, but there's this episode where one of our characters, the annoying British guy, his like mom comes to visit and, you know, they tell and don't show for the mm-hmm. entire episode that he's got like this bad dynamic with his mom, where his mom is like kind of selfish and whatever. Similar kind of thing that I think they're going for with the Buckley parents. But for one thing, this is like 4 or 5 episodes into a brand new show. So like we don't really know this guy well enough for just like telling us about his parental situation to be that impactful. And yeah, that's all they do is tell and tell and tell. Like there's this awful scene, awful, where he's like mm-hmm. at dinner with his mom or something. And he just like starts monologuing to her about like, you always did this and acted this way, which was bad. And I didn't like it. And I remember watching it like, oh my God, not only is this technically extremely incompetent writing, but it feels like a deeply personal rant on the writer's part towards their real life parent, but they have not woven it into the story in a deft way. It's completely amateurish. It's like a student's first screenplay, right? And I just think in contrast, it's so interesting. And I'm trying to think about what works about this one. I think for one thing, the writing is more subtle. We've also been shown the way the Buckley parents needle and get under their kids' skin throughout the episode and throughout certain previous episodes. Like they're not just suddenly springing, like, you know, if Buck just randomly had that monologue as like the first thing we ever heard him say in relation to his parents, that would not be as effective. And also, we've gotten like 3 seasons at this point to get to know Buck and Maddie. So you kind of have a lot more leeway to like expand on those characters, and we have a reason to care. It's kind of bold to just come out swinging with that in the first season of a show. And also, like, they've been building up this thing of, like, Buck being in therapy. Like, we know that he feels uneasy for some undefined reason. We have seen him throughout the show have these, like, self-worth problems. So it's just, and also, I just think on a very kind of basic technical level, like, Buck's monologue here was much better written in terms of just being more emotional and poignant and interesting and relatable and, like, sounding like real words that a person could say versus just like this kind of weird, clunky, extremely literal rant that the guy on Dr. Mm-hmm. Odyssey gave his mom. So anyway, fuck Dr. Odyssey. I'm glad that shit got canceled.
I haven't seen the episode. I haven't seen that episode in question, but I believe you and I'm taking your word for it. Fuck Dr. Odyssey. That show sucked. I watched an episode and I don't even want to say like two episodes or even an episode and a half, because the second episode, I just, I just watched Cord Overstreet scenes.
Yeah, you just wanted to get to Cord.
I did. And I heard Diana was on the second to last episode, but I was not going to fucking watch like the rest of that show for Diana. No, I love Diana, but not for that.
I found it so depressing when 911 Twitter latched on, because there was like a threesome on the show and they started believing that it was a show about polyamory. And I was like, oh, no, you guys have misunderstood. As someone who's watched the first half of the season, no, it's a show about annoying straight people. And they're just trying to do like a sexy, vaguely misogynistic, like, over-sexualized threesome to allow both of these male characters to possess this woman.
I hear it was an extremely heterosexual threesome, by the way. It was not MMF. It was MFM. It was...
I feel like we may be losing at chess to a dog in terms of buddy, but I feel like thinking that Dr. Odyssey was going to be like a queer show was like, I don't know, losing at badminton to... like a dragonfly
It's like, I don't know, it's like the dog's not even playing chess anymore, he's not even at the table.
The dog's asleep outside and you're like, and you're just still sitting there like,
how do I
like,
get
God
into
damn
checkmate?
It, how does he keep winning?
What does the pawn do? Does it go backwards?
But speaking of losing at chess to a dog, we go to a nice little buddy scene where Buck is angrily punching a punching bag and Eddie is just watching him kind of serenely, quietly, broodingly. And it's a great role reversal from season three, where now like Buck is doing the thing where he angrily channels all his anger into punching stuff and Eddie is being this sort of calm in the storm for him. And
I'm sorry, I promised myself I would talk about Glee less, but this is giving so, like, you remember that episode where like Blaine blew up at Sam and then went to hit the punching bag and then Finn went to talk to him in season three or whatever?
Maybe.
Right. That's just whatever I see whenever I see like one of these like punching bag boxing scenes in media anymore. I'm just, oh, Darren, Chris, your legacy here.
But I love the way Eddie is being supportive in this scene, the way he's like, you know, Buck says something about like, yeah, I guess I'm going to have to apologize now. And Eddie's like, why should you apologize? Like, you didn't do anything to apologize for, which... If he could show anything like this towards his girlfriends, I would be less obsessed with him being gay.
Buck says something really interesting here, actually, where he goes, you know, like one conversation and I'm like 12 years old again, you know, and like that, and that like really spoke to like sort of the core of their dynamic, because like that is so like, I don't know if you get that with like, you know, when you're in a fight with your parents, but I definitely get that so hard. Like, you know, my dad will be like going off on me and suddenly I'm just like 12 years old again, like.
That's why I'm glad I moved out of the house. But Buck is like, I just want to hit things. And Eddie's like, yeah, I tried that last season, but it didn't work that well. Buck gets a call
from
Maddie.
And it wasn't that well received by fans either.
Yeah. You know, it wasn't a very good show of my limited acting range. And Buck gets a call from Maddie, but he doesn't pick it up. Instead, he just kicks the punching bag even harder because he's so angry.
And then we get like it's almost comedic, the sort of dichotomy here, because we hard cut to May you know, at the
Athena
household. Yes.
Athena's
at the station. No, you're right. It is Athena.
And her colleague comes up to her and is like, yeah, congratulations. And she's like, it's not that big of a deal. I just like fucking solved a murder and it turns out it was a corgi. And he's like, no, I mean your daughter. She saved a lot of people yesterday. And it's like Athena hadn't even really heard about this. So yeah, then at the Grant household, May comes home. Like, Athena does the scary parent thing where she's like, I want to talk to you. Come down here. But it turns out, it's just because they've prepared a little surprise party to say congratulations on graduating or whatever.
It's like
we bought a bunch of cupcakes and spelled 911 with them.
Imagine how different Buck's life could have gone if he had a supportive and actual nurturing influence in his life like this. You know
honestly,
what I mean?
Honestly, though, that I think it's like he's hot. He's like good at sex or whatever. He's like kind. He's caring. If he was well adjusted and had been well socialized from a young age, he would be too powerful.
That's true. That's He's true.
Tall.
God had to
you know
him.
I think it's everybody, every person like that needs like a little bit of fucked upness, or else it's just not fair.
Yeah. If only there was an episode of the show down the road that explored what Buck's life would have been like if things had been different. glad that doesn't
it was
exist.
Really not that good or interesting. Yeah. But anyway, one thing kind of bothers me in this scene where, like, after they've done the surprise party, you know, Athena takes May to the side and she's like, you know, I can't believe I had to find out from my coworker that this had happened. I wish you would have told me yourself. And I was like, Athena, I'm sorry, you don't have any right to be upset that May didn't tell you about like whatever she was dealing with or achieving at work, when all Athena has done this season is be so non-supportive of May's career choice. Like, all she has done is made it clear to May that she doesn't like that she's doing this, and she wants her to quit, and she doesn't think she's capable of it. Like, I wouldn't tell her shit either. So I didn't, it's not like a big deal, but I thought in this scene, like, I wish they would have had May be like, well, like, I didn't exactly feel that comfortable telling you, or I didn't feel that supported telling you about work or whatever. And maybe Athena could be like, you're right. I'm sorry. Like, I can see you're really thriving or something.
Yeah. Wait, I'm sorry. I'm still on this because you said this and I want to circle back to this. I know we're at the end of the episode and we're almost done. I need to circle back to this and it'll be quick. Did the cupcakes spell out 911?
Yeah, they did. It's kind of cute.
I did not catch that. I could not make it.
They even mentioned it because they said it was too short notice to get something custom, so they just got her cupcakes and they.
Yeah, but they just say they got her cupcakes, and I was looking at
right,
them like,
but
I know it's a
the
shape.
Pictures,
but
that
I
are moving
don't know.
On the screen, you can see that they.
I fucking was.
They spell out 911.
I fucking was. Maybe this is just my brain being bad at this.
I watched this episode on a plane and I noticed.
I'm like, I'm really bad at like word scrambles. Like, I've never been good at those, or like word jumbles or whatever they're called. So maybe that's like the part of my brain that's bad at processing abstract like imagery like that. But I'm not that creative like that. You know, I don't have the mind of a master. What's that called?
I mean, you don't really have to be like creative just to notice that clearly in the shot they've spelled out 911 with the cupcakes.
Well, I wear glasses, Jane, so that's ableist.
True, I'm being so ableist right now. Maddie and Buck are at home. They sit down together.
Oh,
Maddie's like,
here we go.
How are you doing? and she's like, you know, you don't have to defend me. I can take care of myself. You know, he felt the need to, but he says he feels embarrassed about the way he went off on mom and dad.
Okay, I'm sorry. I can't think about the nuanced conversation that they have leading up to the big reveal. I'll be just like, the
okay,
baby
who
box
cares?
Comes
who cares?
Out.
They're just
the
talking.
Baby
they're,
box
they're
comes out.
Decompressing.
They're just talking.
The baby
they're
box comes out, and Buck notices a little picture in there that he assumes is him, and he's like, oh, look at that handsome devil, you know. And Maddie's like, oh, that's not supposed to be in there. And he's like, what? You don't want pictures of me and your baby box? And then he looks at the back of the photo. He's like, 1988, that can't be. I wasn't even born then. Something
so
something
good.
Check
so
the
good.
Math on Buck's age now. And he's like, wait, Maddie, who is this? And she says, that's Daniel. He died. He was our brother. Cue the EastEnders theme song, you guys, because we have just ended with a real dun-dun of a moment, as they say in the EastEnders community.
This is one of those soap opera twists that you have to like buy into, and it honestly takes courage to enjoy, but it is... Like, this is so good. This is such good drama, because it's the kind of thing that, like, you know, they're setting it up in the episodes leading up to this, and then the further we get into it, the more fucked up and depraved the story becomes.
Yeah, no, because like on its face, I could see fans almost being like, "What? Like that's it at the end of this episode?" But it's like they had no idea, right? Just how crazy this would get. Because it does beg the question, it's like, okay, if they had like a brother who died before Buck was born, like then why did they cover it up from him? And such questions will be answered.
In due time. I love this show. I love the drama. I think this is so well done. This episode was so good.
Yeah.
This episode was so good.
It's always fun to end with a big bombshell.
Yeah. I honestly don't think I have any... I guess I do have one final reflection, which is, I guess, circling back to that question of why does the parent drama work on this show where it fails... excuse me, in others, right? Even recently in others. And I think the answer, like you said, is that they spend so much time, you know, showing us like what this relationship is like and building it up in a very natural way, with like, you know, a very realistic framing, which is Maddie's having a baby, she's inviting her parents over, etc. Yeah. And they allow that dramatic tension to sort of like build and unfold in a very organic way that doesn't feel like, I don't know, ham-fisted into the story. We've heard like whispers about their parents in the past, and like even their absence, you know, throughout the entire show up to this point is telling, right? Like where are their family? You know, where is their family? Because we see we see Hen's family, we see Athena's family, we see we don't see Bobby's. We see Chimney's. We know about them. We know about the Diazes, etc. We don't know anything about the Buckleys, and that in itself creates this mystery, right? And
Agatha Christie-esque, like, even.
Agatha Christie-esque, even, right? And the way that it sort of unfolds through, like the family coming to dinner and having a little get together, and just right off the bat the needling and the reactions and everything, it's just a really well done example of like the way that you can show this, and still it's like having your cake and eating it too, you know. You can earn the big dramatic emotional blow up monologue ranting at the writer's parents moment and have it feel organic to the situation because of all the work you put in to get there. So that's why it works for me, you know. That's why I feel it.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with all that. And let me tell you, I have walked through fire to be here today. I was in a different country this morning, and it is now currently approximately 2 a.m. on the time in the what's that called, the time whatever it's Central, 2 a.m. for me right
London
now
time.
Time zone, time, yeah, whatever. And I'm feeling a little eepy.
A little eepy.
So
we can wrap it up here in that case. Thank you guys listening.
Thanks for joining us on another 911 episode.
Mm-hmm. And thank you for sticking around for a little break.
And tune in for next week when we'll cover another 911 episode.
Yes. If you would like to support our podcast further, follow us on social media at First Risk Podcast, spelled how it sounds. Or consider subscribing to our Patreon. We have a very fun topic today for this month that I'm very excited about. Today, we're doing it today.
We're about
this.
To record our October Halloween episode.
Mm-hmm. It is a very spooky time. The winning topic this month was watching Halloween movies starring 911 actors.
It won by a hair. And I was very excited about that.
If you know the cast, you already know where this is going. This is going to be so much
fun.
I can't
wait.
I am so excited to watch Halloween movies during Halloween season. I normally don't actually do that. I normally don't even get around to it because I have other stuff going on. So I'm happy to be able to set aside some time for this and do it in this sort of structured way. And then just like nerd out about how much we love Jennifer Love Hewitt and Angela Bassett.
Right.
So on that note, thank you guys for listening. And, you know, fuck them kids, right?